Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
No one tells a roast joke quite like my guest on today's show.
In all seriousness, I want to thank Alec. In his memoir, he bravely admitted that he had once considered suicide. And I just want to say that that meant a lot to me because I have also considered your suicide, and I have some ideas.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was Nikki Glaser giving it to Alec Baldwin on Comedy Central a couple of years ago. Nikki's appearances on that roast, along with the roasts of Rob Lowe and Bruce Willis, helped turn her into a legit stand-up comedy superstar. Then came her 2019 Netflix special, Bangin', which only cemented that status. Now, in addition to hosting her own daily podcast, Nikki is also hosting the highly anticipated and utterly ridiculous HBO Max reality show F-Boy Island, in which, well, I'll let her tell you about it in this episode. I've been such a huge fan of her comedy for so long, so I was thrilled she finally took me up on the offer to come on this show. Here's me with Nikki Glaser. Awesome. Well, I've been listening to your podcast and really enjoying it. And now all I really want to know is, what is this mystery show that you're working on in LA? I'm very intrigued.
You know, the funny thing is, I don't think it's going to come out for like a while, and which sucks because I want to talk about it so much. I didn't know any of the rules. I was on it yesterday I did 2 days of it this week. And, the first day I was like on my phone taking selfies, like on set, you know, when we were stopped down, when it was like, I felt an appropriate time to do so. And I always have my phone. Like I always am sitting on my phone if I'm on a show, or like I just am addicted to it. And, I got like kind of yelled at for being on, like someone was like, why is your phone out? And I was like, oh, it's because we're not filming. I'm going to put it away. And they're like, no, you can't have your phone in here. It's a closed set. And I was like, okay, well, what if I have an email? We're like doing a 9-hour day in here. And like,
that's crazy.
And also, it's just a fucking TV show. I mean, it's nothing. No one's going to die because I may have accidentally revealed that I was wearing this color on this show that might come out in the future. Like, it was all coming down to like, you can't even take a picture of yourself in the outfit offset because part of the reveal of you is like what you're wearing. And I'm just like, well then why didn't you guys give me a budget for wardrobe? Why did I have to spend $3,000 out of my own pocket to get dressed for this when I was making $7,000 to do the two full days on set? I mean, it was one of those shows that you're like, I'm paying to be here.
It's worth it.
But not in a complainy way. This network, no one has any goddamn money, especially cable networks. So I understand that. And the money's being put towards good things on the show, not talent, I guess. But but they treated me like a queen, and I had a great time, and I looked amazing, which is always a conflict in my head of whether to dress like a comedian or like stay in my lane, or to embrace the fact that I'm having these opportunities to go on red carpets and look glamorous and look like a model, you know, like I can really sometimes like look like, oh, she like, I have like, I'm 37, but I have the body of a 70-year-old supermodel, like where you go, whoa, she's still kicking it. Like I have like an elderly supermodel body, as a 37-year-old, which sounds like I'm bragging, but it's also, I'm not. Sometimes I can really, I'm already going places for with you, Matt, that, I didn't intend on going, but that's actually an interesting struggle talking about like the current state of comedy is this, you know, with Instagram and putting so much out there of optically of what you look like, and people telling you it's about your jokes, like focus on your jokes, don't focus on how you look, and denying that that's such a part of all of this. And
easier said than done.
And it's also like, I don't want to ignore my looks. Like I don't care anymore. I used to be so ashamed of trying to look hot. Oh my God, my biggest fear is, you know, people on set thinking that I'm a diva and spreading that message about me, because that's all I never want to be, someone who looks like they think they're better than anyone else, because I don't feel that way ever. I could use more of it, actually. And then my other fear is being thought of having other female comics who I admire and look up to screenshotting me on Instagram in a group message and talking shit about me. And these are founded fears, by the way, because I've been in those group texts of female comics talking shit and going, look, oh my God, we're worried about her. When really it's like, she looks really free and like she has confidence, and I wish I had that. And I'm threatened by the fact that she can be sexy and own it. And I'm going to talk shit so I can convince myself, like, I don't even want that, even though I secretly do. I wish I could be that sexy and out with it. But so now I'm just kind of indulging in that. Like, I am single. I don't care if I'm perceived as sexy. I should be. I'm trying to find a mate.
Put it out there.
Yeah. I'm trying to find someone who looks at me and goes, oh, that makes my dick fill with blood. And I kind of would like to put my penis in that. Like, that's the initial thing I want. I'm sorry.
That's the goal.
I'm not trying to find a life partner by someone going, oh my God, she's so funny. Like, that's not what I'm looking for in a relationship, is someone who tells me I'm funny all the time, because I know I am. I just want someone who like tells me I'm fuckable all the time, because I don't know that I am. So until I find someone to love me forever, I'm going to keep putting thirst pics out there. Why not?
Well, you know, it's talking about looking hot, your new show, F-Boy Island, that's a big theme of the show. Did you like that pivot?
It is. It was so good.
So I have to say, I was kind of following you, you know, on social media, and you were living with your parents in St. Louis. And then all of a sudden there's just like these pictures from this tropical island, and I didn't know what was going on. I was like, you're just like living your best life in some beautiful place. I thought maybe there was some sort of like Firefest thing going on, but I wasn't sure. And then eventually we find out it's F-Boy Island. You were down there working on that.
Yes.
So how did this happen? How did you end
up? That was the other secret show that I, you know, was started my podcast when I was down there. Couldn't talk about it. It was very clear that I couldn't tell you anyone what it was, but that it would be something you'd find out about soon enough. Yeah, it was F-Boy Island. That all started because I put my agents on a mission probably a year and a half ago, maybe, you know, prior to COVID. I want to work in reality. Like, I love reality shows. I don't know why I'm just trying to break into scripted when I don't even watch scripted shows. Sure, I love scripted shows. I got into them more over the pandemic because I was living with my parents, so I was able to watch. I don't like consuming things alone. And for me, reality, it's easier for me to consume as alone. But a lot of times with reality shows, you develop a network of people that you get together and watch it with. So like the ones that I love, I have my friends that we like have Bachelor Mondays or whatever. But with scripted shows, I can't get into them because I want someone to comment with me, and I was a single woman who worked every night. So I just never looked at, watched them. But I did get into them over the pandemic again because I was living with my parents. That being said, I told my agents I want to work in reality because it's all I watch. Why am I trying to make content that I don't even enjoy or have a passion for? And I've watched enough reality to know exactly what I would want to do, what voice I would want to bring to it.
Hi, guys, and welcome to F-Boy Island. I'm Nikki Glaser, and you have all really let yourselves go. I mean, are you even trying? You look great, actually. I didn't know that GNC sold jewelry, but that's nice to know now. I actually have those jeans. Are those mine? Out of the 24 of you, 12 of you are nice guys, and 12 of you self-identify as F-boys. And I don't know who is who.
I did Dancing with the Stars. So I've been like,
I was kind of surprised after your experience on Dancing with the Stars, you want to do more reality.
Oh my God.
Didn't go exactly as planned.
No, I was voted off immediately. The first voted off, which is like one of the most embarrassing moments of my life, and was really something that I thought couldn't happen. I didn't even have my bags packed, which you're supposed to have them packed just in case you get voted off. I didn't have them packed. I had to fly to Good Morning America to be on Good Morning America the morning 10 hours after I was eliminated. I was supposed to be live on air on the other side of the country and I had no outfit, nothing planned for it. It was chaos. And everyone's like, you didn't know. We all knew you were going home. It was like, rigged.
You know this game is rigged, right?
And you can just look at the schedule. You can just feel the vibe of the producers not making eye contact with you and everyone not really worrying about your next dance as much as everyone else is.
Like, no, so, you don't need to rehearse for that yet. I think it'll be fun.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that actually was the reason I fucking got injured on... I mean, my Dancing with the Stars experience is one I'm still processing and I think is something that I'm bringing to state. It is going to be a big part of my next special, even though I've talked about it on my Degenerate special that I did for Netflix, which is one of the most insane sets I've ever done. I was truly on the brink of a mental breakdown when I did that set. So it's like, yeah, oh my God. It was...
When did you tape that one?
I did that one less... like 5 days after I did the roast of Alec Baldwin, which roasts are like the Olympics. I train for them. I don't sleep enough. I do sets tirelessly. It's just like, it's the hardest thing I ever do is roast until
you're incredible at it. So
thank you. Well, I just know that they're the biggest platform for a comedian ever. I mean, maybe next to hosting the Oscars, which is not in the scope of things for me yet, very soon, but like for now. And I would argue that more people see roast clips than your Oscars monologue.
Yeah, it's also an interesting comparison, right? Because the roast, you can kind of get away with anything, and the Oscars are the thing that people are getting canceled for just by accepting the gig. So they're kind of on opposite ends of the comedy spectrum, right?
You're so right. I mean, that would make me nervous to... It makes me nervous to do anything like that or to be a little bit more famous, because that's when people start sorting through your past material and trying to find ways to take you down because they don't like... They kind of have seen too much of you and they're ready to now go from being like, oh my God, I love her, to, ugh, she's everywhere. I'm so sick of her.
Okay, you haven't had that experience yet where people
it's coming. Yeah. And I know exactly the jokes they're going to come after me for. And
do you delete things from your past, or you just kind of let them ride?
Honestly, well, you know, I hired a friend of mine. I was getting ready to go on tour. I wanted to come up with new material. And so many of my jokes, I mean, I've been on Twitter since 2012 or whatever. Before, no, 2008, seven, I think seven is when I first got on. And I was like, oh, well, you go through it, because sometimes my tweets are so brilliant. They're just like brilliant one-liners because I used to really work hard on them.
Maybe
not so much now.
Them.
But like, yeah, I could bring those. I could just shove those into bits. That's how now I write, is like, I always used to write in one-liners when I first started out. I was just like, loved Mitch Hedberg, Sarah Silverman, Wendy Liebman, just Stephen Wright, just like, just one joke and let's move on. I don't want to like get into it. And then I found out I was talking about so many topics that like were similar theme that I could put all these one-liners into a bit. And then that's how kind of I came up with my style now, which now starts with a story. And now, then I fill in with jokes. So now I was like, oh, let's go back and look at tweets. And I told my friend Nicole Buchanan, hilarious roast comic, Nicole Buchanan. I told her, will you go through my tweets and like find anything that you think would be good material? So it was essentially her looking for stuff I had written. But, and then I go, she was doing it for a couple hours because there's so much to read. I mean, and I go, you know what? While you're in there, but you just like maybe clock anything that might be a little bit like maybe not timely anymore. And thankfully she didn't find any. She was like, no, there was maybe this. And I was like, oh no, leave that. I don't care.
Yeah,
that maybe 5 years from now, that'll be something that I can't say. But, you know, I really was scared for a while because I do have jokes that are written from the perspective of racist people that are like ignorant, you know, like the Sarah Silverman character that I was.
Yeah. Exactly.
Legit,
that was
like,
her. That was kind of her shtick.
Her.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote my own jokes, but I copied that character of like, I'm unintentionally racist because I just am a selfish person who lives in like thinks everyone has my perspective. Like her joke
That's
about
a really
sending,
good impression of her.
Thank you. I did it for 8 years of my career, and so my whole act was just I used to do impressions, but it was one, and it was Sarah Silverman the whole time, and I didn't acknowledge
and
it.
You didn't say it was an impression.
Yeah.
Do you think there was a moment or a set or some time in your career where you realized you were doing yourself, or you had found something that was authentically you?
Yeah, I think that is authentically me. I think acknowledging that I had such low self-esteem, have it almost by default, that I had to transform into other people and absorb things from people I admire in hopes of becoming more like them is kind of myself. Being able to like acknowledge that and admit that and have that kind of perspective was maybe is kind of who I am. It's like that's kind of my brand now, is just being accountable and really honest with what is going on and what, and kind of dismantling any perception of me that might be like, she's such a badass and so confident. Like, I want people to be inspired by my confidence, or the fact that I can, how can you say these roast jokes to these people that's so brave and talk about all these things and admit, talk about your sex life? It, to me, that's not brave. Like, I just don't have the thing in my brain that prevents me from doing those things. Like, there's no like, oh, I'm scared, but I'm going to do it. Like, there's nothing that impedes that.
Moment. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard them on my podcast, but I compared it the other day to like that free solo guy that like hangs off of cliffs and you go, nothing? How do you do that? Like, I stand against a window on a 13-story building and I get sick to my stomach. So, but it's like, I have a thing that's saying, don't do that to protect myself. He doesn't have that part of his brain. And so I'm still figuring out who I am on stage, but it is really fun to finally be in this position that I was talking about it yesterday on the mystery show I was doing with the hosts and the other people on it that who I respect a lot and who have had a lot of experience in this business. And it's nice as someone, I've been in the business now, I'm 37 and I started when I was like, you know, 19. So like 18 years, I've been like, my career can vote and drive and buy porn for its whole life. I mean, let's be honest, porn is accessible to everyone. That used to be the thing. But I was talking about, I've just discovered a hack for bombing, like an easy out immediately, which I've been employing just through knowing good lines to say when you start to bomb, or you've presented an idea that people don't like, or you've said something offensive that you didn't mean to, and everyone's like, everyone hates you. You just stop. Like sometimes, because I used to bomb and I would feel immediately if I'm bombing, a trickle of sweat starts to build on my lower back, maybe mid back. And until it reaches my ass crack, I find that when I feel it reaches my ass crack, there's no turning back and they hate you so much. But if it can dry up and not gain enough speed, like it's only going to accelerate towards my ass crack if I keep bombing. But in that time, I have that little window down my back. To
turn things around.
Yes. And now I know how to do that. What I do is I pause and I go, instead of trying to dig out of this bit by getting them to like me more or picking another bit that, oh, you'll like this one, what is the most honest thing you can say right now? Like literally what is the, and for me, most of the time it's, I'm sorry, I'm not as good as you expected me to be. That's really cuts through it. I go, I'm sorry that maybe you're here because you watched my roast compilations on YouTube, which I just want to be honest with you. I didn't write a lot of those jokes. I'd never look that good. I was peaking that night. Those were even edited to take out the awkward silences. So I'm never going to be that person that was, and I know on the car ride home, you're going to be like, maybe we should have saved up money to go see Andrew Schultz or whatever. You're like, maybe this is the wrong choice. I don't like her as much. But if you are able to really call that out, they're not going to have that conversation on the ride home. They're going to be like, I can't believe she like knew we were going to say that. And I have like, and maybe they weren't going to say it. Sometimes people go, why are you calling out something? And people actually do like you. And it's because I always fear people don't like me. And I would rather win over the people that don't than focus on the ones that do, which is a sick thing that I hope to remedy. But I really feel like just the key to being funny is being honest. You don't actually have to have jokes. If you just say honest stuff that people wouldn't normally admit, you could be a comedian. That's all we're doing. I mean, that's all I'm doing. And I'm trying to be like punchy about it and have smart jokes, but you don't even have to. Like, people are just such fucking liars always, all the time, in every little way. Like even comedians who are your favorite comics going, I'm so excited to be here. The energy of this room, like, or even saying, even wearing something cool. Like for me watching, and I would say this to Chappelle if we were ever friends, hopefully, if I got high enough and made the poor decision of being like, I'm going to be honest with him. He'll never hear this. But for me, when Chappelle, I loved... Chappelle is like obviously the biggest truth teller. I just trust him so much. I don't think he's ever bullshitting us. I don't think it's going to be a Louis C.K. situation where he's presenting a side of the yeah, real version.
That there's this that whole other person that palatable. We don't know about. Or, yeah.
Because the thing about Louis is everyone's like, he told us he was a creep. But I'm like, not in that way. Or that, like, you know, that victimized
there
others.
There were signs, but we didn't know the whole
story.
Yeah,
like, you should have seen it. Like, you know, what were you wearing kind of thing. And I don't feel that way. I don't really... Louis is one of my favorite comics of all time, but I don't really consume his new material because I just don't trust him anymore. Whatever. That's my choice as an art. Like, I'd still tell him he's my favorite comic, but I just don't want to listen to him anymore, really, because he broke my trust and I rely on
He was your favorite
comics.
Comic back in
He was. He stuff. Is yeah. still. Like, yeah, his bits are still ones that stay with me and have changed the way I think about the world. I will never complain on a flight again the rest of my life. If it's delayed, if it's bumpy, if the Wi-Fi isn't working, I will never, ever... My calmness on a plane that has been delayed for hours and hours and keeps getting pushed on, we're on the runway, alarms me. And it's all from the fact that you're flying through the air like a bird, like magic, like a bird. The thing that it used to take, you know, months and a bunch of people would die across the way. Now you take a shit and watch a TV show and you know, he really.
Yeah, that was the bit. I think he did that on Conan, right? And I think it blew up from that, right?
That was the best one, the Conan one. And then he later put it into his act. But the Conan one was the one that blew my mind. So the thing about Chappelle that I wanted to get back to is that he, to me, is what I aspire to be in terms of just like one time I saw him on stage. I remember the Comedy Cellar and I was watching him and I couldn't even listen because I was just so profoundly just inspired by how comfortable he looked. Like, you just are in good hands with Chappelle. There's never a moment as an audience member. And that truly is what comedy is about, is making the audience feel comfortable because you're doing something that is scarier than singing on stage, acting on stage. At least you have a script and lyrics. Talking on stage alone with a mic is everyone's biggest fear. The audience is fucking nervous for everyone that goes up there. You just want to make them feel like, the best feeling as an audience member is like, I'm not anxious for them. I'm not putting myself in those shoes. Like, oh my God, what if he stumbles? Chappelle never, he's in the driver's seat and this car cannot crash.
Yeah,
like,
and he'll just take long pauses and do whatever he wants up there. And yeah, you're not worried.
You're in for the ride. You don't feel awkward ever. Chappelle's never awkward. And he just seems so cool. Like, he doesn't care what you think. He truly doesn't. And I believe he doesn't. Then that special, I think it was Sticks and Stones. He's wearing a onesie. Like a looked like a mechanic, like a car mechanic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And looked cool as fuck. Has the Chappelle patch on the side.
He always has his branded stuff now.
Okay. Let me just say that a guy that doesn't care what people think about him and truly has no like ego does not have that cool of style and put patches with his name on it on things. So that for me, Chappelle would admit to this, I'm sure. Like there is an ego there. There is like someone who cares about his perception, which makes me love him even more than that. But I just, this guy that I've just like, he doesn't give a fuck. Like there's a little bit of I can find like the cracks in the facade of like, I am so confident. My favorite image though, to think about with that onesie look, because that was one of my favorite sets. He's just fucking cool as shit. It's just so, the vibe of it is one that, you know, kind of, it was before he was getting really, just kind of deviating, I think, from the stand-up, the classic stand-up, like what you expect. That was like in the round, I think, the one, whatever it was. That, I just want to say that I loved the image of Chappelle. If he had to take a shit at any point, or he had to take it all the way down to his ankles, he was naked on the toilet, because I've worn onesies before and to go pee as a woman, which men, obviously you could stand with a pee, but if he had to take a shit, he had to be naked with the whole onesie around his ankles. And that to me is such a humanizing moment for this guy that I put on such a pedestal. So I love, but that's what I'm talking about of like trying to be, there's always more. There, you can always get more honest. And I now am going to lean into, for my tour that I'm doing now, I've decided like I'm going to do wardrobe changes. I'm going to dress like Taylor Swift on a stadium tour because I want to and I can. And these are big nights. And I want to show my audience that I'm excited and to respect them with my wardrobe and like show them that I care. And I wish I could Adam Sandler and like be embraced for like wearing what I want to.
Mesh shorts and yeah.
I don't care about being, I used to say, oh, I don't want to perform in heels because I'm not comfortable in heels. But it's like, no, I'm going to feel like I just, like I was saying at the beginning, I'm just like not scared of acknowledging, like, I'm dressing up because, not because I want to, but because it makes me feel cool and I want to be cool so bad. Like, that's the truth of it. And I want to look hot because hotness is currency and you can pretend it's not, but I will not be a woman who will say, I love my body. I love my curves. I look at my cellulite. If I don't feel that way, I hope I get to a point where I can put my cellulite on Instagram and go like, look, girls, it doesn't matter. Not there today. I'm not going to fake like I am.
Coming up, Nikki runs through the highs and lows of her three Comedy Central roasts, from destroying Ann Coulter to revealing some uncomfortable truths about Roastmaster General Jeff Ross.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. We have had so many other comedians on the show who first broke through on the Comedy Central roasts, including Lisa Lampanelli, Anthony Jeselnik, and Natasha Leggero. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Nikki Glaser. So I do want to talk a little bit about the roasts, because I was looking back and I realized you've done three of them. They're actually the three that I was there for in person. So I feel like I have a very strong memory and connection to those. So then they were kind of a game changer for your career, as you said. They made you blow up in a new way. So I just kind of wanted to run down the three that you did and see if there are memories or things that stand out for them. So the first one was the Rob Lowe roast in 2016. And I remember it mostly for Ann Coulter's horrible bomb of a set. And I loved that, looking back at it, that you really went at her, I think, harder than anyone else on that stage. So what do you remember about that?
Amy Schumer was really in my corner for that set and preparing me. And she was someone that I had, you know, helped with jokes before. And so, and it always followed her process. And so she really was like, this is a huge opportunity to like be, to tell this woman what we all want to tell her. Like, she's truly evil. And so I just went to a place of like, I really want to go hard, as hard on her as possible, because for the first time at a roast, like, she really deserves it. Like, you can say we roasted Donald Trump before, but we didn't know how much we all would hate him. Like, there's rarely been someone there that is that loathed and deserving of being loathed and knows what they're doing and has made a character that is evil on purpose because they're a sad person inside. And it just felt good to, I would love to do it again with what I know now. I mean, it was my first roast, so I made some choices that I didn't like. Like, the joke that honestly broke my career open, I don't regret it, I guess, but I kind of do, was the one that was like, the only person you'll ever make happy is the Mexican who digs your grave. I didn't like that I said Mexican. I look back on that joke and I'm just like, that's making me someone who assumes that Mexicans dig graves, which I guess is a stereotypical thing that you could put into joke, but everyone loved that joke and was like, that's so mean to her. And I was like, I feel like that joke's more mean to Mexicans for no fucking reason, like saying that that's all they do. And it's a foregone conclusion. It's going to be a Mexican. And obviously Mexicans hate you because your immigration beliefs are like, it, to me, that joke is always quoted back to me. And I cringe when I hear it, because if I were Mexican, I would have been like, this fucking bitch just throwing us in this joke. We don't need her to speak for us. And it's a great joke, and it wasn't written by me, and I took it on right before I went on stage. I added it to my set because why not? And I remember everyone in the trailer was like, that joke. And to me, I already had those kind of like spidey sense of like, this doesn't feel good. And then every time I hear it, I'm kind of like, ugh.
And without furor ado, Ann Coulter. Oh, Ann. What's it like to be like a real life supervillain? You know, like, I'd ask you how you sleep at night, but I'd assume just upside down in a robe of 101 Dalmatians. Ann Coulter has written 11 books, 12 if you count Mein Kampf. Yes. Ann's been called things like a racist, anti-Semitic, homophobic, a white supremacist, and that's just while getting plowed by Bill Maher. The only person you will ever make happy is the Mexican who digs your grave.
With that roast, though, it was the first time that I had experienced the thing of not know. Like, it happens every roast. Like, I write all these mean jokes and then I get there and I forget that they are going to be sitting there when I say it. Cause I've said it so many times around town. I literally forget. And I remember being on the red carpet before that. And one of the people being like, so how do you feel about saying these jokes to these people? And I was like, oh my God, I had not even thought of it. And you know what? That's my superpower, is this like inability to think about the scariest thing until it's about to happen and it's too late. Like during my special taping for Bangin' on Netflix, I was in the middle of my set talking about like guzzling cum or just something filthy. And I see my dad's head, and my dad and mom have seen everything I do. They know what I talk about. I don't hold back at all. And it was the first time that I was like, that would be really hard to hear if you were like a parent. Like, he's probably doesn't want to hear this at all. Like, this moment is so probably fraught for him because he's so proud, but at the same time, so embarrassed. And I stopped and I go, dude, you guys, I'm sorry. I just have to say, my dad's here. And like, for the first time, I just realized like this might be hard. And he's been coming to my show since the beginning. And I've been like this from the beginning. And
yeah,
it's like,
but that special is like to a new level. But yeah.
Yes, this empathy that I have maybe for others, or like how someone else might feel on the other end. I lacked empathy a lot in my life, didn't grow up with learning it. And it kind of hits me across the face sometimes when I least expect it. And I'm glad for that ultimately, because it's allowed me to be so brazen on stage and say things that most people wouldn't, because I'm not thinking about how people will respond.
Yeah. I wonder if that helps explain why you're so good at the roast.
I think it does. Like, it really is like this, the fear of heights that free solo guy has, I just don't have when it comes to offending people. But also when I find out I've offended people, Matt, I'm so upset and want to find them and right the wrong. Like, I don't enjoy offending people. That's the other thing. People think I love making people feel awkward. And like, I hate when my last theater show I did, doing a meet and greet, and I open with setting up the scenario. If you had to like go down on either of your parents, like, who would you choose? And it's not just for the sake of being like a awkward question. It's like, I explore this thing that comes up naturally. And then this kid is with his parents and he goes, that was weird for us. And I was like, I am so sorry. I literally might put a disclaimer next time I do it and say, if you're with your parents, will you go to the bathroom right now? Because this is too weird. I don't want to put you in that position. It's just, yeah. So moving on, Rob Lowe roast was definitely like the best, was the night that I got to prove myself to Comedy Central. Like, you were right in hiring me to do this. I can't wait to do it again. And I feel really confident about what I did. And I worked my fucking ass off. And I was a little hurt by the jokes that they said about me. And I didn't expect that. But, you know, just as I don't see I don't have empathy for the person on the other side of my jokes, I did not prepare myself at all for what would be said about me at all.
Yeah,
I had no idea that I would be
thinking about
hurt.
That.
No. And thank God, because it was better in the moment. I don't know. I usually get wildly depressed after these because I'm like, oh, I have to get injections in my face to change so they won't say that next time. And then they'll make fun of you having injections in your face. You can't win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I talked to Natasha Leggero about this. You know, we were talking about sort of the way that there's only like a handful of things that people say about female comedians at these roasts.
Old sluts, old slut, not funny. That's it. And
and you kind of move from slut to old as you do the roast,
and then
right?
An old slut becomes like gross. No one wants you. And how pathetic is that? So it's like, and it's funny at these roasts, like I go first all the time. So any jokes about me not being funny just don't work because I just killed. And I love that there was one time where I forget who was up there doing, it was someone like really impressive that I was like, oh my God, I can't wait for them to talk, even say my name. And I remember I just so undoubtedly killed that there was a joke on the teleprompter that was about me not being funny. And they just go, actually just skip that one. And they like told the prompter to skip it. I was like, oh my God, I love that, because they just didn't work. So yeah. So I tend to hear jokes about me looking like a transsexual, like a male to female transsexual, or me looking old, or me having no ass, or me having a horse face. I mean, these are all things you say about skinny women, or having an eating disorder, which, you know, is true, but like who, or was true, but like, who cares? I don't know. But they do find new ways to like really hurt my feelings, which is the, you know, it's the goal.
So the next one was Bruce Willis in 2018. Is there anything that stands out from that one in your memory?
The big thing for me was that was so fun because I got to sit next to Edward Norton, who I was a big fan of, very intimidated by. He didn't really have much to say to me before the show. Like we were sitting there and he was kind enough, but like we weren't like chit chatting. I was just like, oh, I guess we're not going to be buds or whatever. Cause he was probably nervous. I was too. We're just, you know, whatever. And not rude at all. Just like, oh, I wanted to like have a connection with this guy. And like, cause it's a really social thing. Your handlers don't get to be on stage with you. There's not hair and makeup coming in. When you go to commercial, there's a whole commercial break for like 7-8 minutes. And you're just there with no one. Like you talk amongst yourselves, you really get to know these people, you mingle around. It's really fun and a great opportunity to meet someone who you would never normally get to sit next to. And so then, but I go up and I do my set and then I come back. And now Edward is a fan because he just saw me work and respects me more and is much more chatty and like just, you know, all of a sudden we're front and it was like, yes. So then I gave him after his set, I split an edible with him. We were just like, he was telling me hilarious stories about Bruce from like when they worked together and was just talking. I had a real like night with Edward Norton. Like I got Edward Norton alone and was able to be friendly with him and social in a setting that I don't think anyone else could ever get that person of that caliber as coming in as a stranger in that situation. So that's,
Did you stay friends?
No, you know, I was hoping that he would like slide or something or find a way to get in touch with me so that we could remain friends. But no, but I do know that if I ran into him again, he would remember me because, yeah, it was like a lasting, it was a mutual admiration. It felt so good to be able to perform. And then like, because I get that, like when I meet someone who's super famous, who I like love, I know that they would love me, but they're not aware of me. I want them so badly to see me perform so that they can have respect. But yeah, that was my memory for Bruce Willis. And then
Alec Baldwin.
My memory from Alec Baldwin. God, my memory from that was being devastated afterwards because I forgot to do two jokes that I had, you know, in a Google Doc before making my final choices. And there was one joke I was moving to another section, like my best joke. I had two jokes that were I had like so many jokes. My best jokes, most of them had been cut. Three of them had been cut. I'm not going to say three. Two had been cut the morning of because Caitlyn Jenner found out that someone had been practicing a set around town talking about her car crash. And she did not want jokes about that. And Comedy Central hadn't told me not to do those. They were like,
were there no jokes at all about it in the whole thing? I don't remember.
Wow, no jokes at all. And there were, let me tell you, and some really good ones. And I did them
because
on Howard Stern.
People were probably like, well, it's better to joke about that than joke about the trans stuff.
Would think, but and I go, unless I'm told specifically not to do something, I'm going to do it. And Comedy Central was like, we just strongly suggest you don't. And I go, but have you heard that from her? And I go, can I talk to her and ask her? Like, just let me, and they wouldn't let me talk to her. So the morning of, they finally go, listen, she heard that someone might be doing jokes and she said she would walk off the stage if that happened. And I was like, okay, then I'll pull them. Like, I don't want, like I said, I don't want to make anyone uncomfortable. That was all I needed from you guys. But when you tell me, we don't know, we just don't think, I'm going to do it. Right. So I took those jokes out and I took that hit and I was like, okay, we got to make this set stronger. Then there was another joke that I loved so much. That was a dumb one, but it was just like, Alec Baldwin has a podcast called Here's the Thing, which is exactly how he introduced Caitlin to me backstage, which I just thought is just like a beautiful joke. And I just thought it was a great transitional joke to the, it was just part of the set that I needed. I was excited to do. And I fucking forgot. This is what I did. I cut instead of copied the joke on a Google Doc. I cut. Someone came in the room and was like, what do you want from Starbucks? And I was like, oh, blah, 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 blah. And then I go back to the doc and I don't remember never pasted. So it just didn't end up in the script. And then I'm on stage and I heard someone reference his podcast and I go, and I'm like, oh my God, like, can I get up and like do it again? I almost literally asked for a pickup. Like I was like freaking out. And then afterwards I cried at the after party. I had the set of my life. That was the set that blew me up and changed my life. And I was devastated. I couldn't have any fun. And that was one of the last times I let a regret during a live performance send me into a tailspin, because I did it with Conan when I did Conan over Zoom during the pandemic. I had a fucking meltdown after that, thinking I had fucked everything up.
Can I tell you about that? I don't know if you know this, but I put you on my list of the best performances of 2020.
Because I was so obsessed.
Yeah, I think you tweeted, yeah. But that was... I was so obsessed with that Zoom bit from Conan.
That made my... I'm so glad I brought that up.
It's a very visual bit, so we can play a clip of it here, but you really should go watch it if you haven't seen it.
My favorite thing about Zoom, and you got to do this when you're in your next Zoom call, you got to look for this moment because it happens every time. You sign off of the call and you're like, this was really fun. Thank you so much. Okay, guys, we'll follow up on that. Thanks. Everyone have a great day. Okay, cool. And then just after that, cool. And then the people looking for the leave meeting.
Yes.
Yeah, about like, and it's still true. You still have to write, you end a Zoom meeting and then you go bye, you click, and then you have to click leave meeting. And it takes the time between saying bye and clicking leave meeting, your face falls into who you truly are.
Yeah, because you were like the first person to have that observation.
Thank you. And like, someone would have gotten to it. Bo Burnham would have done a whole song about it on his special suicide note. That's what I'm calling his special. If I were friends with him, I'd check in on him, but I've been trying
to get him on this podcast, but he has not done one interview about it.
Honest guy.
That
was so honest. I was, you know, almost scared, but that's the kind of thing that I was doing over the summer when I was suffering through depression and like suicidal thoughts and like just didn't want to go on. Like I was tweeting things that were called cries for help. And I was kind of looking at his special, like a cry for help. And I was like, should I reach out to him? Even though I don't know, like, I'm sure people are checking in on him, but a lot of times when you present your mental struggles through comedy, people just assume it's not real or it's haha. And you're just like, will someone check in on me? Really? And I talk about it in the stuff I'm doing now, but the one tweet I did do about like, oh, I wanted to shave my head, because that was like something that my brain was telling me to do last summer was shave my head, which is not a good sign for
Britney Spears.
Yeah. Like it really was like, I was angry about the patriarchy and I just wanted to reject my hair, which was already falling out and causing me so much stress. Cause I was, you know, just whatever. So I tweeted about it, made a joke, and everyone's like, haha, faving it, retweets. Okay. The only one person reached out to me to be like, are you okay? Like, I saw your tweet. It was Joe Rogan. I've only spent two podcasts with him, 3 hours each, but that's a significant amount of time to spend one-on-one talking to someone. I mean, most of my good people I'd consider best friends. I don't know that we've done that intensive conversations eye to eye. And so that's just to say the Bo Burnham thing, but for the Alec Baldwin roast, I was just devastated afterwards. But the one thing that I do remember the most that's been talked about a lot is that, and a decision I stand by, is when I assembled my writing team for that, I always give like kind of a mission statement for each person. Like, here's what kind of jokes to write, because I want the joke to come from a place of truth of how I feel about them. And for Blake Griffin, I was like, I just want every joke to be about how hot he is and how I want to fuck him. And people, my writers are like, but it's a roast. And I'm like, find a way to make it work. So for me to be able to do that, because the thing is, I'm really bad at letting boys know I like them, or guys, I call them boys, but like, cause they are, but I'm so brazen on stage, but I'm not good at being like, I like you and would entertain going on a date with you. Like, even though like, or I don't like slide into people. Like I would rather make jokes about it so that I can get off on the fact that like, if he doesn't want me, I can be like, oh, they are jokes. But if he does, I'm like, I just like gave you the in. Like, now, you know,
did he take the in or anything happen there?
Well, it was funny because we definitely had like a nice time talking before, and we were sitting right next to each other, like randomly enough, because I asked to be placed next to him at rehearsal. And it was already placed that way, but I just said to the director, I go, Joel, please leave this. He goes, it's tentative. I go, please leave it.
Yeah.
Just please leave him next to
Can
me, because I knew
permanent?
From the Edward Norton thing, like whoever you're sitting next to, you really talk to all night. And he left it. So no, we definitely were having like a flirtation. I could feel like a mute, you know, I went up, did really well. So I got that Edward Norton, like a little bit of like interest, respect vibes from him. And my whole set was about wanting to fuck him. So it was kind of like, ah, sorry, did you? And he was like, oh, you know, and it was sweet.
What are you going to do?
And then he got up on stage and said I looked like Larry Bird, and said I couldn't pass for 33 like Larry Bird because he was number 33. And he said a couple other things that were like so mean.
Larry Bird is here. I mean, Nikki Glaser is here. You know, the only difference between Larry Bird and Nikki Glaser is Larry could actually pass as 33.
Devastating.
So, I'm sorry, you were so nice earlier. Yeah. Nikki, look at you. You damaged little climber. You know, Nikki was the only girl kicked off Jeffrey Epstein's island for networking.
I know who wrote those jokes for him. I believe that Jimmy Carr had written jokes for him. Then that's not like blowing his cover. Like, Blake is hilarious, legit hilarious.
But everyone gets people to write jokes for them.
Yeah, he. I probably wrote as many jokes in my set as Blake wrote in his. Like, there's no shame in having other people write. And Blake truly is a funny person, but I think Jimmy Carr wrote some of those jokes, and Jimmy is always a person that whenever I'm in a setting where he can like poke fun at me, like I've had him on my radio show a couple times, and he can be so mean. He can like see me in ways that I don't, he's just too acute with his insults, and they can be so mean about my looks, which I do not handle well because that stems from feeling like all of my insecurities are just not from feeling like that I'm like somehow ugly. That's why I talk so fast, because I'm scared and like I don't want to be heckled, because I'm just scared someone's going to be like, you're ugly. Like, I know that's like the craziest thing, but like that's my biggest fear. So when I found out Jimmy, I was like, Jimmy fucking Carr. And I think maybe Neil Brennan too. And Neil is very insecure about his looks, so he's able to write to that as well. So he's able to really nail it. And so when I found that out, I was like, fuck those guys. But at the time I was more like, fuck Blake, which was a good feeling, because if a boy is mean to you, in the past I'd be like, I like him more. But this made me like, ugh, you like are able to say those things about me. Like, I don't want my husband say, and I know that like we our arms had just touched, but I was already marrying him in my head. I'm like, I can't marry someone who said I looked like Larry Bird. This is over. He did slide into my DMs eventually, because everyone was like, fuck Nikki Glaser. I went on Howard Stern and talked about it. I think everyone was tweeting at him like, please fuck Nikki Glaser. Like, she's dying for it. And he tweeted at me. He like DM'd me and was like, the people have spoken. I think we have to give them what they want. And I was like, yeah, I'm down or something. And then we were going to like hang out if he ever came to New York. And I guess he just hasn't come to New York at all.
I guess not.
Even though I think he definitely is
probably
there.
Has. Yeah.
And we have not connected ever since. But I did.
Right. Well,
you know what? I got the slide in my DMs, and that's probably all I really want in the end anyway from him, because I'm scared of intimacy. Yes.
The other joke that did stand out to me rewatching it is the one you made about Jeff Ross. That's how do you get tens? I mean, teens.
Oh, yeah.
That's one that's aged kind of complicatedly, I would say.
Unlike the women he dates. No, I'm just kidding.
Jeff gets really hot girls, and how do you get tens? Teens. I'm sorry, I read that wrong. How do you get You have the sex appeal of a gymnastics doctor. I just don't understand.
I'm friends with Jeff Ross and feel very conflicted about all of that.
So am I.
That joke was actually used in like someone wrote something about the allegations or whatever against him and referenced that joke as like, she knew. And I'm like, no, I know that his girlfriends were like decades younger than him, but so are every male comedian in their 40s, 50s, whatever Jeff is.
So you weren't exposing some open secret
there.
Yeah,
no, it was me making a joke of how he dates young hot girls, but not like illegal hot girl. And you can't take roast jokes as facts. Although, you know, I am trying to call out things that maybe people wouldn't know about other people. But in that case, it wasn't me. Tens and teens is hilarious. Like, it's just fun. That was just a fun joke construct of thinking that I was reading it wrong or what. And it's just, it was in, I guess someone could say like, oh my God, she knew what would the accusations that would come out. But I didn't. And it was not from that place. And it just was a coincidence. And I hate even talking about any of this stuff. As you can tell, I'm like tensing up and like,
I didn't
I'm
getting
mean to a
workout make you tense
from.
Up.
No, it's okay. It sucks. Because
it's
even like I was talking about the Z's thing recently on a podcast and I was just like, can we just move on? Because honestly, see both sides of it. And I never don't want to trust women. And I also know that, and this isn't Aziz or about Jeff or about anyone, but I truly believe that, you know, I could be friends with a lot of monsters. Like, I think there are a lot of people out there that have done disgusting things to women and men, both women and men that have done disgusting things. And my whole policy now is keep working. I don't care if you keep working. Bill Cosby, go on tour. Like, I wish I could literally kill him with my bare hands. Like, he's the only person that I would probably want to murder just because I've seen his show. Actually, I've hated Bill Cosby since he came to my college in 2006 and I fell asleep during a show. Like, I've always hated Bill Cosby. I've just gotten a sense. I didn't know that he was going to be the most prolific serial rapist we've ever known, but allegedly. But I just feel like it's up to the consumer whether or not you can. Canceling is, I'm just really, as much as I was on board with cancel culture for a while. And now I just think it's not, I'm really scared of it. And I think that everyone just needs to make up their mind whether they want to consume it or not. I'm trying my best to love everyone and hear everyone out and give everyone the benefit of the doubt before I can't try to cancel or pile on. But sometimes it's tempting because sometimes you already hate someone comedically and then they come out as a pedophile and you're like, yes. And you go, I can't wait. I've always resented your success because you're not even funny. And now you're a creep. Fuck yes. And so for some comedians like Louis, like I said, I can't watch him anymore. It's not that I wouldn't enjoy him. I probably would love his new stuff, but I've heard he doesn't talk about the thing. He kind of casually references it of like, how was your summer or whatever.
I feel like if he did an hour about that, and
I would
was
be
able
back
to,
on board.
Yeah, I know. I think it would make a huge difference. And that's why I don't know why he doesn't do it. Cause I think it would.
So confusing to me as well.
Some credit, you know,
I'm sure he has his reasoning but that's the thing. It's like, it's a personal choice for me. I don't understand why my brain works this way. I can still enjoy Michael Jackson. I can still enjoy some Chris Brown songs that aren't about like loving and cherishing women. Because for me to enjoy those songs, I need to believe the person singing them loves and cherishes women. So what he's done goes against that in order for me to enjoy it. For me to enjoy Thriller, I don't need to think that he hasn't molested children. Don't know why, just doesn't in a part of it. Louis, to enjoy him, I need to trust him. For this comedian I'm talking about, that we both know who I'm talking about, I don't need to trust that he's not done bad things to women. For some reason, I don't need that. And I honestly wish I did, because I wish that my morals were that in line with everything else in my life. They just don't. I'm a vegan. I care about animals endlessly and in ways that people don't understand. But when it comes to this, I for some reason can still laugh, and I still follow him on Instagram. And maybe that's indefensible and you should stop following me because of that. So be it. I can't help it. I still think he does a really funny Eminem.
So we end with the first laugh, which is our speed round. So can you remember the first piece of comedy or comedian that really made you laugh?
Yes. The ones that occur to me first are ones where I watched my dad laugh and I was like, oh my God, I want to do whatever that
is,
my dad
is making him laugh.
Wendy Liebman said on the Tonight Show, I remember I was like probably in fourth or fifth grade, Wendy Liebman, and I'm talking about stand up here for some reason, just like really big comedic moments. Wendy Liebman goes, so I just quit smoking crack and it's going really, and my dad like was like, that is brilliant. And that, I mean, that explains everything about who I am, is that joke. And then, there was another Sarah Silverman joke that my dad was like read to me in, middle school, that it was like in the New Yorker. I remember she was like, this was before Jesus Magic. She was probably still on SNL at this point. And it was, my doctor molested me, which is so bittersweet as a Jewish girl. And I remember, yes, he was laughing and I go, I don't know what that means. Cause I grew up in St. Louis. I didn't know any Jewish people. I didn't know stereotypes of Jewish people. I knew about the Holocaust and dreidels and that is it. And like literally didn't know anything.
I'm impressed you knew about dreidels.
Thank you. It was a Pee Wee Herman Christmas special that actually taught me dreidel. Yeah, all that. So I remember that he had to explain to me Jewish stereotypes, like racist Jewish stereotypes, to understand the joke. So that was like a weird moment for us as a family. And then, but the first joke that got me that I always remember and one of those ones that really stuck with me is, and I say it to myself all the time, is Ellen DeGeneres talking about in one of those specials after she came out, HBO ones, she's going to the bathroom and she goes, sometimes when you're trying to get the toilet paper out of a stall and it's like turns into streamers.
I
and she goes,
this, one.
This is no time for celebration. This is no time for a party. Or so this is no time to be celebrating. She goes, it turns into party streamers. And she just goes, this is no time to be celebrating. So anytime that happens to me, I always go, this is no time to be celebrating. And it makes me laugh so hard. And that's why I love Ellen DeGeneres, by the way. I feel,
even though she's canceled too.
Yeah. I'm going to definitely be talking about her on stage, especially as she keeps losing power in Hollywood. It becomes more comfortable and you can be more brazen about your, yeah, the things you've heard. But no, I will always love Ellen and I think she's one of the best stand-ups ever. But if you watch her, if you're a true fan of her stand-up, you knew that bitch was evil and not evil, but like had a dark side. You are not that funny and have jokes that take such twisted turns. I mean, that was a bad example of her dark side, that joke I just told, but go back and watch her specials with knowing what you know now or what you've heard now. And it'll all make sense. It's been there all along. She's too funny to not be, have a dark side. And that doesn't always have to be one that you keep from people. In her case, she chose to kind of hide it, but it wasn't being hidden to me. I think that's why I love her so much, is because she's a bitch.
Do you remember the first joke or roast joke or something, first joke that you told that really worked and connected with an audience?
Yes. I had a joke that was my first set on stage, not the first joke I ever told on stage, but in the first set, I was trying to be Sarah Silverman. And I wrote a joke that was, I was 19. I was in college at the time. And I was like, I was 18. I would love to have a baby someday. I would love to be pregnant someday, but I'm just waiting. I know I have to wait until I'm mature enough to handle an abortion. So that was like one of my first like little like kind of, and I haven't heard that joke since.
Yeah.
It was like I thought that it would almost be hack at this point, but that was the first time I was able to like do my own spin on an abortion joke, trying to be Sarah, you know? and then I had another abortion joke shortly after. It was like, and then when I was still young, it made sense. My mom recently told me she was pregnant. And I'm fucking 18 years old. And I was so upset. And she was like, Nikki, please, I'm really going to need you to help me take care of this baby. And I was like, you know what? I will, mom. And that's why I pushed her down the stairs. So that took care of that. So that was like, that was a fun play on that took care of. And that joke actually got me the attention of like headliners that would come through and go to the open mic, you know, before they were their headlining week, they would come in early. And I remember Jim Florentine seeing that joke and being like, you have to do guest sets for me all weekend. Like that joke is so funny and dark and twisted. And so it was like little things. That joke means something to me because Jim Florentine allowed me to like do guest sets, which was like the first, he was one of the first headliners to ever believe in me. And it wasn't trying to fuck me. And which, you know, people probably assumed, but Jim Florentine, Doug Benson, like these people early on that just saw something in me because of one good joke I had really changed my life. And Matt, I seriously thank you so much for highlighting that moment from the Conan as one of the funniest moments of 2020, because making that list was really meant more to me than like, it meant like as much as like winning an Emmy did, because it just felt like I just trust your sight and like the taste level that you guys have. So making that list like made me feel so fucking cool and at a time when I really needed it.
Well,
so
that means
thank you.
A lot. And yeah, that still is, I will rewatch that when I want to laugh. I love it so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
So yeah, thank you so much for doing this. I will tell you, I was very excited to have you because I've now had all six comedians who were in that first stand-ups. You're my sixth. So I had Nate Bargatze, Fortune Feimster, Dion Cole, Beth Stelling, Dan Soder, and now you. And so I feel like I've achieved something.
Yes, we did it. Check that out.
They're all really great specials.
Netflix.
So yeah,
that was a fun one where I talk about my dog going down on me, which I don't even remember those jokes, and I hear it back sometimes, and I'm like, oh God, what were you talking about? So that was a good one too. Thanks, Matt.
Okay, that's gonna do it for another episode of The Last Laugh. I want to thank Nikki Glaser so much for talking with me today. You can watch the first three episodes of F-Boy Island starting this Thursday, July 29th on HBO Max. And make sure to subscribe to the Nikki Glaser podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.